As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
And I was listening to a podcast the other day. Their opinion is that cancel culture doesn't really exist. It's a moral panic. And I think there's some truth to that. Like, I think a lot of people are disproportionately worried that they're going to be cancelled when they almost certainly aren't going to be. But then they said, and part of the reason why there's such a moral panic going on was because of me, like John Ronson.
It's been a good run lately, hasn't it? Carl Zimmer, David Robson, Richard Dawkins, and now one of my all-time heroes. It's journalist, documentary maker, and podcaster John Ronson. I've been a fan of John's work since I read The Psychopath Test while I was living in Brazil about 8 years ago. And I was still an aspiring writer and journalist and was simply blown away by John's writing. He hits the nail on the head in this episode when he explains how he was so worried about boring the reader. It means that his work is just an absolute joy to read. Every sentence is either funny, elucidating, or chilling, depending on the topic at hand. And those things are pretty useful when you're reading a book about psychopaths. You want to sometimes laugh and then sometimes feel a bit scared. He's also known for writing So You've Been Publicly Shamed, a book about the way we publicly humiliate others for minor transgressions. There's a lot of discourse about that today, of course, but John was ahead of the curve when that book came out in 2015. In his work, he often documents his time with extreme figures, including Alex Jones, David Icke, and Islamic militant leader Omar Bakri Muhammad. His other books include Them, Adventures with Extremists, Lost at Sea, The John Ronson Mysteries, and The Men Who Stare at Goats, which was made into a movie starring George Clooney. He co-wrote Frank, another feature film starring Michael Fassbender and Maggie Gyllenhaal, and Maggie's brother, Jake Gyllenhaal, starred in John's acclaimed movie, Okja. I've seen and read all of these things while devouring his podcasts, The Butterfly Effect and The Last Days of August. Many people see him as the Louis Theroux of books, and they've talked before with one another about a bitter rivalry that they had when they were up and coming, which has now sort of subdued and become a lovely friendship of mutual respect with a competitive edge. John comes from Wales and he worked at CBC Radio in Cardiff. His latest podcast is called Things Fell Apart, and it is about the beginnings of all of our different culture wars. It's completely unique in that it doesn't pick a side, and the genius lies in finding stories of such magnitude and social consequence that somehow escaped mainstream attention until now. Each episode takes on a different struggle, whether it be how abortion came to be such a hot topic between tribes, how offence was caused at the dawn of the internet, or where third wave feminism came from and how it relates to trans rights. As ever with John, the human is always at the heart of the story. You'll find that on BBC Sounds, so download that app. From next week, the 25th January, it'll be available worldwide. All you Americans, Australians, Europeans, South Africans, and people from other places will be able to listen, I mean, literally everywhere, because it'll be on the normal podcast platforms from the 25th of January. So I honestly can't recommend it enough, and will remind you next week as well. We talk today about cancel culture, public shaming, the internet, and the podcast Things Fell Apart. Thank you so much, John, for making my Christmas, that's when we recorded this, by coming on the show. I hope you will come back in the future sometime as well, as there's so much more I wanted to ask you about. I hope that the Ronson fans listening will subscribe to this podcast. If you like his work, you might like a lot of these episodes. Please do get in touch with me to let me know you're listening to it. AndrewGold_OK, Twitter, Instagram. Sorry to my bonus people, as this is the third time this month there's been no bonus. It's just very tough to ask these big name people like Dawkins or John Ronson when they've got loads of interviews to do some homework and, you know, stay for the bonus questions. But next year, so hopefully in the next couple of months, I'll be doing 2 episodes a week and you'll get a lot more bonus episodes. I promise. It's just been a rough patch for bonus episodes. Please do leave me a review on Apple or Castbox, or give me a 5 out of 5 on the mobile app for Spotify. A lot of people saying that's not really working at the moment. Maybe it is now. And enjoy listening to the soothing, dulcet tones of John Ronson's voice. I'm so scared of, you know what, I'm already at ease. It's a funny thing. You have a nature about you that puts people at ease. And as I get very, and I know you get yourself quite anxious. I get very anxious doing this, especially Zoom, because suddenly the person pops up. And sometimes they're scientists and doctors and things. And they're people like Daniel Finkelstein, you know, very serious. And I'm so scared. And you came in just like a breath of fresh air and you, hi, hello. And I'm already relaxed. Oh. So thank you for that.
Oh, good. Even though I actually came in flustered. So you saw me at my very worst.
Yeah, and all the horrible racist things you said before we started recording. Oh,
and even that, no. But, do you get nervous, like, for technological reasons? Do you get nervous for social reasons? Because I sometimes, like, you know, I get very nervous before doing an interview. Not being interviewed, weirdly, but interviewing someone, but it's kind of for reasons of social awkwardness. It's the same feeling of awkwardness that I get on my way to a dinner party on the exceptionally rare occasions that that's happening, that I haven't said no.
Exactly. It's exactly that. It's also because, and I don't know if you feel this way, there seems to be sort of 2 kinds of people in the world, and there are sort of jokey, funny, relaxed people, and then there are very serious people, and you probably need both in the world. But those serious people, I get very stressed talking to them. I might say the wrong thing. So, Richard Dawkins or someone like that, I wouldn't want to have them on the show because I'd be so nervous in the lead up to it. Do you know what I mean?
Yes, yeah, absolutely. I once signed next to Richard Dawkins at an event, and he only signs his name. And he won't say, like, if somebody says, can you make it to Judith? You're like, no. And he'll just sign his name. But that doesn't mean that his fans get to go home a lot quicker than those of us who want to do great big sprawl, you know, want to, like, do a great big message each time. So I'm very torn between whether that approach is rude or the opposite, actually. Consider it.
Yeah, I can expand on that story with Dawkins, just because I was on a podcast which you might have probably been on at some point called Humanists. I don't know. It's the Humanists podcast.
Right. I've never been.
Well, I was a guest on there to talk about my documentary stuff, and just before the guy who was interviewing me, he said, "Oh, I've just got. Sorry, I was late. It was a minute late. I just got off the phone with Dawkins. He was the interview before yours, and he said the thing with Dawkins is very difficult to interview because he does just give. It's almost the same as a signature. He just gives like a one word answer. He's very to the point. And he said the opposite would be like David Baddiel, who he had as well, who's also come in on this show, because David Baddiel was very much he went back on himself and went back and forward, and he's never sure of what he's saying. And he said that was a nightmare to edit compared to Dawkins. And at the end of that episode, I said, like, so how was that? Was that all right for you? And he said, a bit more of Baddiel. You were a bit more Baddiel than Dawkins. And I thought, oh, no, he hated it. He hated it. So that's...
Well, as a matter of fact, so I'm in New York, and I noticed that David Baddiel was on his way to New York because he was on the Seth Meyers show a couple of days ago. So I messaged him, and look, because I tend to message people when they're passing through town, so I can see some old Brits who I used to know. And so I messaged him. And yesterday, me and David Baddiel went to the matinee of Jagged Little Pill, the Alanis Morissette jukebox musical on Broadway.
Oh,
yeah. I liked it very much. I found it very moving. When I told my wife I was doing it, she said, are you dating David Baddiel? There was a slight oddness to it. These two old blokes sitting in a musical that's really geared towards young women.
I love that album, because I'm a very bitter person, I think. And I try not to be, but there's a lot of bitterness and resentment and stuff. And that album, I can't think of a more bitter album. Is there? I mean, literally, the name Jagged Little Pill.
Yeah, it's a very, well, just like, you know, Sondheim or Candor and Ebb, you know, the great thing about Broadway musicals is how they can go to very dark, serious places. I very much love that. And Jagged Little Pill does that. It goes to some really dark places. It's written by Diablo Cody, who's, you know, who wrote Juno. Yes, if anyone's on Broadway, I mean, it's very social justice-y. So if one sort of gets annoyed by social justice messages, then I would say still go, because by the end of the show, it just expresses itself in a very moving way, I thought.
Oh, well, fantastic. Yeah, it can be hard not to get riled up if something has a slightly... And we'll talk about that as we go on, won't we? I mean, that's what everything's about, isn't it? You know what I'm interested in? I don't know if you remember, but I'm a huge fan of yours, and you don't have to say anything to that, because what do you say to that? But I've seen Frank and Okja.
Okja. Thank you.
Okja. Fantastic. Okja. I think I said that right. Okja.
Okja. Like the oak tree.
Right.
With a J at the end.
Okja. 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 And exactly. and then what about Jake's last name?
you've put me on the spot. It's a soft G. Hang on, which one's a soft G? Is that G or J?
Soft must be J.
Yeah, it's Jake Gyllenhaal. Let me just try and picture me going up to him and introducing myself, and then I remember how I said it, and I remember... hi, you're Jake Gyllenhaal. Yes, it's Gyllenhaal. I didn't say Gyllenhaal. That would have felt very wrong.
Well, you probably didn't say his last name, did you? Or maybe the first time.
Yeah, you must be Jake Gyllenhaal.
You must.
Don't you always address celebrities by their full names?
I never address anyone by anyone's name, because I have this fear all the time, even though I know obviously that's my dad. I don't want to get the wrong, it's bound to be wrong. It will come out, I'll be thinking dad and it will come out mum, or I'll be thinking John, it will come out Ron, and I try to avoid actually saying someone's name live as much as possible.
That's very wise. And of course, I didn't address Jake Gyllenhaal by his entire name. That would have been odd.
I've heard him say, because I looked it up before, like, how do you pronounce his name? And he's been asked on talk shows. And then I think he's throwing a spanner in the works, because he says something with a bit of a smile. And he goes, it's like, gul-lul, or something. And like, come on. So right. As I was saying, so I've read the psychopath test, loved it. I diagnosed everyone I know as a psychopath. Loved all of them. Publicly shamed, love it all. And I told you, I think a few weeks ago, my brother never read a book in his life, and he started reading The Psychopath Test, and it got him into books and Kindle and stuff. So,
well, that's great to hear. That is great to hear. I very deliberately wanted to write, you know, because The Psychopath Test, you know, it could be a very different sort of read, because it's about mental health diagnoses and the vagaries of them, when it's good, when it's bad. If you become a psychopath spotter, does it turn you a little bit psychopathic in that sort of looking into the abyss way? And so it's about this kind of serious stuff, but I very much wanted it to be a beach read, a page turner. So I wanted it to be as kind of exciting and adventurous and twisty turny as possible. So because I have a short attention span, I think. And so I think I write books for people who have short attention spans.
Which is a remarkable skill.
Well, I do worry a lot about boring people. So I make my, you know, one of the biggest parts of the process of writing for me is making stuff shorter and shorter and shorter. Like if you've got a paragraph and you looked at it 100 times and you just can't take out another word, and then you find another word to take out, then that's like the best feeling, I think.
Well, the other part of that, and I'm glad you say that, because I think that entertainment and comedy are sometimes sort of overlooked facets of journalism and undervalued. And would you consider yourself, in a sense, along with, I think, Louis Theroux and along with Sacha Baron Cohen as well, a humorist?
No, I wouldn't necessarily use that word to describe myself, because I think sometimes my stuff is funny. But and there's times when I'm really looking for the joke, like if something's really dark, I'm very, I'm really looking for the joke. But then other times I don't even think about it. Like if I'm doing a story which just doesn't lend itself to humour at all, the tone of the story to set itself. And I don't want to force comedy in there. It's always storytelling. It's just people lost in a big world.
Yeah. Well, I love it. And I find myself laughing quite a lot at the bits that are supposed to be funny, not, you know.
Yeah, I really want to. I mean, I want to be funny. Don't get me wrong. Like, I'm not sniffy about funniness in journalism. I just don't work quite as hard as I used to, maybe, in looking for the joke. Sometimes I'm more confident with a darker or more emotional thing than maybe I used to be.
That's a really interesting point, because maybe it does come from, I suppose, anxiety, and you feel you have to make someone laugh. As you said, you're scared of boring people, and then as you've gotten older, you feel more confident now.
Yeah, and exactly. If you're doing a show and you know, and people aren't laughing, like you're reading something that's not funny, you have no idea whether people are into it or not. You're standing on stage, you can't see their faces because the lights are in your eyes, and all you're getting is silence. There's something very comforting about people laughing. It's like, okay, I know I've got them in my hand. That's what I think when I hear a laugh from the audience. Yeah. I don't really think that. Yeah, it's definitely like, okay, I can relax now.
Yeah, they've laughed. I'm okay. People like me. My therapist will be happy or whatever. You know, everything's
they're
fine.
They're going with it. I don't have a therapist. Do you have a therapist?
I do have a therapist, actually. I lived in Argentina for 7 years, and that is the world capital of therapy. So I was already quite sort of anxious and whatever, in ways, you know, similar to how you've described your own anxiety sometimes. And everyone, every single person, at least I suppose lower middle class upwards in Argentina, has got a therapist. It's very cheap out there. Yeah, so I started then, and it's been fantastic, to be honest.
Well, that's good. I had a therapist I had a sort of bout of what was called adjustment disorder about 3 years ago, which has got to be the dullest sounding mental disorder.
What is it?
It's a very unengaging name for mental disorder. it's like something that an accountant would do. It's like fleeting depression. It's like situational depression that goes away when you fix the situation that you're in.
Interesting.
Yeah, and so I got a therapist then, and sort of went to see him like two or three times a week. But then when I got sort of better, I just didn't bother. I just didn't go back.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it served a purpose.
Yeah, same. Well, that was CBT. So it's like, okay, I just want to roll my sleeves up and fix what's going wrong. But there's certainly quite a lot to my personality that would warrant visiting a therapist. So maybe I should at some point.
Well, I didn't think about this before, but just as you said that, I mean, I feel that way. I'm from a Jewish background, right? Atheist, as I think you are as well. Mm-hmm. And when you described that, your personality, the first thing that came to mind was Simon Amstel and David Baddiel and Woody Allen and Larry David. How in touch are you? Is that any part of your life, the Jewishness, or is it just a complete sort of red herring?
Oh, no, it really is in that cultural sense. So many of the people I admire are Jewish. Randy Newman, I have been like a massive fan of Randy Newman my whole life. Randy Newman taught me how to write, you know, ambiguity and nuance and double meaning and so on. Many of my heroes are Jewish. I'd say probably the majority of my heroes are Jewish. If you take the religion out of it, we certainly connect on a sort of personality level. We have lots of shared traits. Jews, not all, of course, and you know, this is a generalization, but Jews tend not to get drunk. So there's lots of things, there's lots of weird things that we just all have in common.
I didn't know that, and I don't get drunk.
Right. I mean, obviously some Jews do get drunk, and there are Jewish alcoholics out there, but But, you know, the tendency is for Jews not to get drunk. I don't know if it's something about not wanting to be out of control. You know, we need to retain a semblance of control.
Yeah.
And you know what? People may listen to this and say that's bullshit. But I, anecdotally, I could say over the years, I've noticed that me and my Jewish friends don't get drunk. I was when I got married, my wife's Scottish, and I can tell you that all the Jews, I mean, the wedding was just on the beach in Nantucket, but when we had like a little party afterwards, you know, the Jews tended to be the ones who were staying sober, whereas the, and standing against the wall, whereas the Scots tended to be the one who were doing like, you know, big dancing and letting themselves go and, you know.
Yeah, well, we do the chair dancing and stuff like that, I guess. But yeah, we don't get that drunk. Interesting.
No. Smashing a glass is like the closest we get to letting ourselves go.
Yeah, that was a thing. My brother got married. He got divorced only a few months later, actually. But they did the smashing, even though they weren't going to have any religious or cultural things because she's not Jewish. And they, no, you know, we don't want to be involved in that stuff. That was the one thing they kept was the, and I wonder if it's because it's just this violence he has in him and he wanted to do the glass smashing.
Well, there is something quite dramatic about it, thing, when you put your heel down.
Yeah, it is. And speaking of Jews, I'm making a segue here. One of the episodes in Things Fell Apart, which I've loved. I've listened to 5 episodes. I haven't got to this last one, which I believe is about trans rights and stuff. I've missed out on that.
Yeah. The first half is about the transition from... It's always funny to think of it in terms of the theme as opposed to the story. But I guess it's an easy way to talk about it. But in each of the episodes, what I'm most interested in is the story. It's like the human story, which just then happens to get into abortion or whatever. But yeah, so episode 6, the one you haven't heard yet, is the first half is about when second wave feminism became third wave feminism. And I interview this incredible woman. This has got nothing to do with trans rights. Half the show has got nothing to do with trans rights. I interview Rebecca Walker, who was Alice Walker's daughter, and her father was a Jewish lawyer called Melvin Leventhal. And they had this crazy custody arrangement once they got divorced. For the first 7 years, they were living in the Deep South. They were an interracial couple with a mixed race child living in the Deep South as a kind of ideological point. Like, Rebecca was a movement child. She was to carry the values of the movement through, you know, in her own body, because she was half Black and half Jewish and half white and so on. But then what happened was that their parents divorced and they came up with this bizarre custody arrangement where she would spend 2 years with one parent, 2 years with the other. Like, she could have spent middle school with one parent and then high school with the other, but no. So instead she was shunted just almost randomly between two exceptionally different lives. Like, when she was in her father's life, it was like Jewish suburbia. And when she's in her mother's life, it's like, you know, intellectuals and you know, Black radicals and hanging around Ms. Magazine with Gloria Steinem. And so the experience of leading these, I call the episode Many Different Lives. So the experience of leading all of these many different lives as a child is what was part of the reason why she was inspired to create this new wave of feminism, third wave feminism, which then... You know, obviously third wave feminists fought much more for trans rights than second wave feminists did. And so I try and take the pebble thrown in the pond. Each episode is about a pebble being thrown in a pond. And for this one, I try and take it back, you know, decades before there was any kind of conflict to do with trans rights and feminism. So I was very pleased with that. Like, you know, part of the reason why I wanted to tell origin stories and go back into the deep past as much as possible. Not so deep that people are dead, like everybody I talk about is alive and talk for themselves in the show. It's because it sort of de-emotionalizes it a little bit, it takes the rage out of it a little bit if you go back to the past. All I could say is that I was very, very conscious to try and make a series that wouldn't pour oil on any fires. And that's what I wanted to do most of all. And I'd say that the series has succeeded to a very large degree.
It's fantastic. I've enjoyed just amazing. And some of the things I've actually been, I hesitate to say it, but flabbergasted. I've been flabbergasted every now and then.
Hey, it's Andrew. If you're enjoying Heretics, there's another podcast I want to recommend to you, especially if climate change, global conflicts, and an upcoming election are making you feel like we're on the brink of disaster. What Could Go Right is hosted by Progress Network founder Zachary Carabel and executive director Emma Varvalukas. On What Could Go Right, the hosts sit down with expert guests to discuss the world's most pressing issues without resorting to pessimism or despair that we hear so often. Instead, they look back at how far society has come and look forward at what it will take to achieve an even brighter future. Is progress on the way? They may not have all the answers, but on What Could Go Right, they're asking the key questions. Tune in to hear interviews with upcoming guests like writer Coleman Hughes, CNN host Fareed Zakaria, and economist Alison Schrager. If you're looking for a weekly dose of optimistic ideas from smart people, join them every Wednesday on What Could Go Right, available wherever you get your podcasts.
$1,000, the first episode. I went and made a documentary about abortion rights in Argentina. I went and followed a woman called the Crazy Baby Lady. It's why people know her. She's like a fervent pro-lifer who like throws babies, like plastic babies, at people getting abortions and stuff. So I've been all involved in that for years, and I had no idea that what was it? It was that
The Schaeffers, Frank and Francis Schaeffer. No, the roots of Christian evangelism being interested, becoming engaged in the pro-life is unbelievable. Like it's a stunning, unexpected story, which is almost entirely unknown. Yeah. And I just found it. I found a little, one of the great joys of making the show was going for long hikes in the countryside, just listening to audiobooks I would never normally listen to. And I found a tiny hint of the story in one audiobook. And then I bought another audiobook, which took me a little bit further down the rabbit hole. And I just found this extraordinary story that violent evangelical anti-abortion, and of course, many deaths occurred. There were lots of murders of abortion doctors. It all goes back, and he will admit it himself, to a kid growing up in the Alps in the 1970s, dreaming of making Fellini-type Hollywood films. That was his ambition. He just wanted to be an avant-garde director in Hollywood. And his ambition led to all of that, led to doctors being murdered.
At that point, it wasn't on the evangelical agenda. It just wasn't something they thought about. And then suddenly he pushed and pushed, and still they weren't interested. I don't want to give away too much, I suppose, because people should go and listen to it. Mm-hmm. But and then suddenly, because feminists turned up and protested against this guy in his small film that no one knew about, that got evangelicals really on board. Does that suggest we're all just big contrarians?
Well, also the media. Like if Planned Parenthood had turned up to protest one of, the Schaeffer's documentaries, and it hadn't been covered by the New York Post, it would have been a very different outcome too. The media, the tech companies, I mean, episode 5 is about how libertarian engineers took over and created the world that we all live in since. And I think often, and I write about this and say we've been publicly shamed as well, I write about how we are unpaid shaming interns for Google and Facebook and Twitter, like we're making nothing out of this and the tech companies are making a fortune, out of our constant, waking up in the morning and wondering who we can get. We're being controlled in ways that we're not really. We think we have agency on the internet, but the internet isn't about us. Michael Furtick, guy I interviewed for So You've Been Publicly Shamed, said that to me. Like, the great lie about the internet is that we think it's about us, and it's not about us. It's about the tech companies who are making a fortune out of us.
Wow. And that's that. Well, that's a point as well I got from listening to your series, was that I guess I think of, and maybe it's because of the circles I run in, I think of like Twitter and stuff of being like really woke and liberal. And like, that's what a lot of friends of mine have gone that way. And I didn't think about how the people who invented the internet were these sort of libertarian techie guys. So are those two just always at war with each other?
Well, I mean, I know, well, libertarians don't like, you know, social justice causes in general. If you go back to like 1987, you've got all of these libertarian engineers who are working on the internet in its most nascent form. And a situation occurs whereby they have to think about what to do about the free flow of information. There was a joke that was deemed, you know, offensive, and they had to decide, you know, do we ban the joke, do we keep it up? And so this was, for the very first time in history, the people who were designing and creating the internet had to make a decision, like, do we just allow all information to flow unencumbered, or do we try and find some way of building civility into this machine that we're building? And I don't need to tell you that their answer was no, fuck civility. The machines must be allowed to flourish. Don't stop machines from doing what machines can be capable of doing. And, you know, and I get it, like, you know, I understand. But what they were doing was setting a time bomb. And the time bomb ended up with the internet full of fake news, trolling, offensiveness, just so that was the world that they were creating.
Are you positive about or negative about the future of that kind of thing? Because I guess we're 30 years down the line. I mean, what's 50 or 60 years down the line going to look like?
My one positive thought is that episode 3 of Things Fell Apart has proven to be the most popular of all the episodes. And it's the most emotional episode. It's about how a televangelist, Tammy Faye Baker, interviewed a gay pastor with AIDS at the time when Tammy's peer group was so vehemently anti-gay, they the word AIDS. You know, Reagan didn't say the word AIDS in public for 4 years.
Wow.
From the beginning of the crisis. Yeah. And that heads all the silence equals death sort of signs that people were holding at the time. And it's because the evangelicals were just so homophobic and they were so powerful. They were putting pressure on Ronald Reagan. But Tammy Faye interviews this gay pastor with AIDS and Steve Peters. And it's so moving. And people were just, you know, I had so many messages after that episode of people saying that they were crying while driving up the motorway listening. And that did make me think, it is an amazing story in itself. It's very moving. Hearing it is very moving. But I thought another reason why people are so moved is because maybe we're just all so exhausted from this warfare that we've all been living in now for, you know, 7 or 8 years, I'd say. And I think people are desperate for connection. And I think that was part of the reason why people were so moved by that episode. So my hope is that, you know, there's been an incredible amount of progress that we've all lived through and should be feeling very happy about, like much more diversity in the media and so on than there was 6 or 7 years ago. But I think the idea of people trying to find ways to connect rather than retreat to their corners and yell is something that I think a lot of people really feel strongly about. So I have a hope that there's going to be more of that in the future. Excellent, we're back. Did you get into a flap?
Yeah, I got into such a state. I got into it because I thought I'd given you the wrong link and everything. You know, when your face gets all red and like sweat everywhere. Oh, man. We're here, we're back. It's an exciting interview. I mean, every interview I do is exciting, but this is a very exciting one for me to do. And it means I wasn't able to think about where we were. We were talking about Tammy.
Yeah, connection. We were talking about, like, I think people felt moved by that episode because they felt like, partly, I think, because they just, people want to connect. You know, we want to connect with our neighbours. Where I live up here in upstate New York, it's really 50-50, like Trump and Liberal. And on a... personal level. I mean, you know, there are tensions, particularly because this area is gentrifying. But in general, you know, people are really nice to each other. You know, one of my Trumpy neighbours will come in and if there's a heavy snow and we don't have a snow plough, they'll just come and do it without even like asking us if we want it done. You know, that people are nice. And anyway.
Do you find yourself, is that something you've learned more as you've gotten older and as a journalist as well? I'm just thinking about my own experience, again, this crazy baby lady woman who was horrible to all the people getting trying to get abortions, was lovely to me and made me lunch and stuff and took me on the school run. And she was like a nice auntie of mine. She hates me now because of the stuff I've said about. Mm-hmm. But have you found that in your experience?
Yeah, I think this sort of change for me came when I was writing Psychopath Test, because it wasn't so much about people being nice. It was more the fact that I think just that realization that we all are flawed. You know, we all have flaws. Having flaws shouldn't feel hierarchical. Like, look at that fucked up, you know, look at that. You know, it should be something that people can connect over. I remember there was that Patrick Marber play Closer, and the sort of thing, the way that they staged it was that all the how do you pronounce it, detritus, detrius, how do you...
I don't know. I've only ever seen that word written.
Okay. Well, you know, the flotsam and jetsam of their lives, you know, the furniture, the suitcases, all pile up at the back of the stage. So you're just accumulating baggage as you get older and older. And that really hit me when I was writing the Psychopath Test. It's like, God, we all have hard lives. You know, our family was going through a little bit of a hard time at that time. And, you know, we all have hard lives. We're all flawed. We all have our troubles. We're all trying to just muscle through. We don't really live in a world of incredible heroes and sickening villains. You know, we're all a little bit of both, you know, and that's kind of what I've carried with me ever since. And I write, and it's specifically about what So You've Been Publicly Shamed is about. And I think it really informs everything that I do now.
Yeah, yeah. Do you find yourself trying not to moralize?
That's a hard word for me, because I mean, I am moralizing in So You've Been Publicly Shamed. I'm saying, you know, it's a moral decision. It's a moral thought that we should be more patient and curious and empathetic instead of instantly judgmental. That book is a bit moralizing. And in fact, I think some people who didn't read it thought I was being like a scold. I was scolding people, and obviously that's not what I try and do. I can't even scold. I can't even scold my dog when she humps my leg. I mean, that's how unscoldy I am.
Yeah. It's been there the whole interview, John. I was going to say, but the dog, no, it hasn't. do you find they misinterpret? And then I think I've seen over the years people tweet you examples of people who have actually done, unlike in So You've Been Publicly Shamed, where they've done sort of one-off bad thing, horrible things, and they've said, look at this, John, is this an example of public shaming? And you're like, hang on a minute, this is just a horrible thing.
Well, this is my problem with the term cancel culture. I think the term cancel culture encompasses, you could say, three very different sets of circumstances. On the one hand, you've got the people that I wrote about and So You've Been Publicly Shamed, which is, you know, private individuals who were disproportionately punished for a minor transgression. Then you've got, in the middle, you've got public figures, like columnists who write, you know, agent provocateur type stuff. And then when there's pushback, they say, oh, I'm being cancelled. And then on the other hand, you've got like politicians who sexually assault people. So you've got like, so I think it's a totally valueless phrase, cancel culture, when it can incorporate those three different, totally different sets of circumstances, each of which should be considered in its own way. So I often have got, my friend John Safra, the Australian journalist, says I've become a shaming imam. Like, people come to me for like I'm on top of a hill making pronouncements.
Yeah, it's a lot of pressure.
Yeah, but basically, when I was writing So You've Been Publicly Shamed, and this was before this whole conversation was being had, cancel culture didn't exist as a term. I thought, well, what are my rules here? Like, what am I against? And I decided, like, I'm not against satire. I'm not against citizen journalism. I'm not against journalism. I'm not against criticism. So what am I against? And that's when I decided, okay, this is a book about the disproportionate punishment of private individuals whose transgressions weren't that serious. It could have been like a misspeaking in a tweet or, you know, a joke that comes out worse than the person anticipated. So I decided that would be my thing. And I do have sympathy with the people in the middle, the adjunct provocateur columnists who get like extreme pushback. I do have sympathy for them, but I also feel that they should be put in a different category. Like those of us who choose to be public figures should be held to a different set of standards than a private individual. So I suppose that's when I sometimes annoy my kind of centrist friends who feel, but I remember like, you know, when I used to write a column for The Guardian, I'd write a column and then the letters page would be full of like, I hate John Ronson. And then I'd write another column and this sort of slightly toxic thing was happening between me and and whoever was editing the letters page at The Guardian, that they were just filling it. Like I knew people liked the column because I gave talks and there'd be full of people who clearly liked it. And I hated it, and I really don't like Britain's sort of often knee-jerk adversarial approach to kind of everything. I mean, I know things are getting better. The Today programme's much better than I think them used to be in terms of opposition and, you know, knee-jerk, everything has to be oppositional. That they don't do that so much anymore. But while I hate it, I don't think it's the same as being disproportionately punished for, you know, somebody with 170 followers gets their life like torn apart for some bad phraseology in a tweet. It's like we should be held to a higher set of standards. So that's why I tend to be like really particular about what I'm writing about in that book.
This was the woman whose life was ruined when she wrote a tweet about Africa and AIDS on getting on a flight, right?
Yeah, she's apart from the only story in the book, but she's probably the most famous story in the book because she's kind of the ground zero of public shaming. In fact, and I was listening to a podcast the other day called You're Wrong About, and their opinion is that public shaming is a moral panic. Like cancel culture doesn't really exist. It's a moral panic. And I think there's some truth to that. Like I think a lot of people are disproportionately worried that they're going to be cancelled when they almost certainly aren't going to be. So I think there's definitely truth to the moral panic argument. But then they said, and part of the reason why there's such a moral panic going on was because of like me, like John Ronson, and particularly the Justine Sacco story. And I would say it's true that the Justine Sacco story scared the shit out of people. Like, honestly, the number of times I'm asked to tell this story, I feel like you're sitting at the campfire and children are saying, like, tell me again the story of Justine Sacco.
She must think you're obsessed with her.
Justine. I get irritated when I hear myself telling the story again and again. But A, I'm asked to tell that particular story a lot and I don't want to be rude. And B, it's a perfect story because it's ambiguous. It's not easy. There's other stories in my book which are like easy. Like Lindsay Stone, who's the woman who posed in front of the sign at Arlington Cemetery. Like, that's easy. Justine's more difficult. So, and for people listening to and now getting frustrated that I'm not actually saying what the tweet was and what the story was, maybe I should do it. So she's on her way to Cape Town, tweeting acerbic little tweets. She's only, she's got 170 Twitter followers. Like she's a PR woman for a big media company, but she's not a public figure. Anyway, she's at Heathrow. And she's on her way to Africa and she comes up with what she thinks is a sort of self-reflexive joke mocking her own privilege in a kind of South Park type way. But that's not how the joke came over to many, many people. So the joke was, going to Africa, hope I don't get AIDS, just kidding, I'm white. So what she was intending to do, she told me when I met her 2 weeks later, was make fun of her own ignorance, like make fun of the American idea of ignorance by doing a kind of grotesque impersonation of it, which is an honourable liberal comedic tradition, I should say, like Randy Newman does it all the time in his songs. But while she was asleep on the plane, Twitter took control of her life and just dismantled it. And by the time she got off the plane, her life was... And she was asleep and oblivious to it all. Like there was no go-go on that plane. So a hashtag was trending worldwide. Has Justine landed yet? Somebody found out what flight she was on and linked to a flight tracker website. So, and people were in bars all over the world. So people were tweeting, I'm in this bar and I really want to go home, but I just can't until Justine Sacco's plane lands because I can't wait, you know, to see her face kind of thing. Like, it was hilarious that we all knew something that she didn't, which was that,
yes,
you know, her life was ruined.
Yes. Dramatic and that irony.
It felt to me like torture. Like in my book, The Men Who Stare at Goats, people would talk a lot about, you know, one of the best ways to like torture people is to just, you know, leap out at them, you know, fuck up their amygdala. And, you know, that's what we were all doing to Justine Sacco while she was on a plane. We were all like, you're hiding in the shadows, waiting to jump out and yell surprise.
Yeah. The social exclusion as well, her not being in on the joke about her. It must have been the most horrible thing. But I find it so hard to understand how, I know we have that urge, right? Because we all have that urge of, like, because we're from some sort of tribe, I guess. And we all have that urge of just like, that guy's screwed up. I'm going to shame him. I'm going to make everyone on my side against him. I have that urge every day. But I would then go, oh, well, hang on, this woman, I don't know her. And like, how could these people do this from a place of we're the good guys and we're going to ruin this person's life because of a tweet she sent?
It was, I mean, nothing like that had ever happened before. This was the first, you know, one of the criticisms I got for telling that story was, well, she must have known, you know, when you write a tweet, it's like yelling into a megaphone in Times Square. But this was 2013. Like, nothing like this had ever happened before. You shouldn't have known that. There was no reason to know that. There was no logical reason why Justine Sacco could have anticipated what would happen to her while she was asleep on the plane.
It's mad. Well, the megaphone in New York thing, like, she wouldn't have had any... No one, people don't... You don't listen to those people. You just walk away. This is written down.
Yeah. And it was because, again, once again, it was because of the media. It was a Gawker journalist, Sam Biddle, who retweeted it to somebody sent it to him, or he somehow saw it and he retweeted it to his 15,000 followers. And that's how it all began.
Another thing from Things Fell Apart, I found every episode, I'm just listening to this, mostly in my car, and I'm just going like, this has totally changed how I thought about it. And I spend a lot of time thinking about this stuff. So for that to happen, it's remarkable. So I really do recommend people listen to the podcast. The Scottish Jewish one, I've always been so against public shaming in all forms, just having read your book, and that's how I felt about it. And then there's sort of a feeling at the end that public shaming in this one, because somebody, a techie person, had told a joke considered anti-Semitic, and people who were, I suppose, the victims of this, they needed to publicly shame in order to get some attention to this. So in that sense, was public shaming like a positive?
Well, I mean, I would personally say in that particular instance, like, it wasn't the most offensive joke in the world. So in that particular instance, I'm like, you know, like, I don't, like, I get it, but it's not like, it's not the most offensive joke in the world. It's a very old, it's the kind of joke, you know, but it's you know, it's about Jews and Scots people don't want to pay for dinner.
Yeah. On Kristallnacht, no less.
Yeah, right. But, you know, I've heard that, you know, I love it, but it's not like, yeah. But in general, I would say, yes. I mean, there's the shaming campaigns have done an awful lot of good in the last few years. When I was thinking about Oscars So White, you know, when you say, do you remember the Oscars So White campaign?
Yeah.
And how there was the whole there was a picture of all the Oscar nominees.
Was it Ellen? No, it wasn't the Ellen picture. It was another round.
No, it was a different year. It was the dinner, you know, there's like an Oscar lunch.
Okay.
Like the day before the Oscars or something, where all the nominees gather and there's a huge group photograph. And this photograph came out of like just a sea of white faces. And a hashtag started trending, Oscars So White. And it was, it was embarrassing and for people and for very good reason. Like when you look at that picture, it's embarrassing. And when you look at the kind of TV shows that we enjoyed just a couple of years ago, where, you know, everyone was white, and then other TV shows that we enjoyed where, you know, all the interesting women are just killed, which is what happens in Boardwalk Empire, with one or two exceptions, which we're watching.
Oh, I haven't seen that. You've ruined it for me.
Yeah, they're all killed. And every time a woman becomes interesting, first she takes her clothes off and then she's murdered. So living through this time of social change, where people are much more, you know, aware of this stuff, and people are much keener to make, you know, to have a diversity of thought and diversity, is great. So, you know, I mean, all of this stuff I'm very happy about. It's just sort of sometimes, you know, when it's used as a weapon on the wrong people, it's not the thing. I don't have to say anything. I've explained what I mean, and I don't.
You've explained it.
Finish the sentence.
You got to love Steve Buscemi, though.
Oh yeah, and I enjoy Boardwalk Empire. Like, we're on the final season now. Like, this isn't a negative reflection on Boardwalk Empire, but what it is a show that's only a few years old has things in it that wouldn't be acceptable today. And honestly, I like, for good reason.
Yeah, we're watching Seinfeld at the moment, rewatching it all, and I love it. I love every second of every moment that George Costanza's on the screen. It's a delight for me, but it's also amazing to see how much things have changed. We've got Sopranos for the first time ever as well. Steve Buscemi's in that as well, and I just love him, but then the things they're doing are quite horrible, aren't they?
We rewatched The Sopranos like over the pandemic, like everybody else, and basically, I think it's just
best show ever.
Yeah, I'd say so.
What about Breaking Bad?
No, I'd say The Sopranos. As much as I adore Breaking Bad, even in The Sopranos, which is the show that has barely dated, I suppose you could say, like, there's a few too many lingering shots at the Bada Bing.
There's lots of Bada Bings going on there. Can I ask you about unrelated stuff? But I was really interested listening to a conversation you had with Louis Theroux about competitiveness and bitterness and jealousy. And I've recently read some Will Storr books, because he's been on the podcast, and he's another writer and journalist just like you guys, who had a huge jealousy problem, he talked about.
Oh, who was he jealous of? Did he name?
Well, it wasn't so much. He said there was a guy, he wouldn't say, he did an anagram, he said Ron Johnson, so we don't know who he was talking about. His was more about, and you know what, I don't think he would mind me saying this, unless I've gotten the wrong person, because I've read a lot of books recently, but I'm pretty sure it was one of his, I think it was Heretics, and it was, he talked about a girlfriend he had, and he used to go out, and then he would come back surreptitiously and check she was still in there without cheating on him, and it took a long time for him to get past that. There's a lot of jealousy, so it was more about women there, but I get very, very bitter, and it's one of those things, like with the public shaming, where I have to go, all right, stop it, other people are allowed to have success who aren't you. Is that quite a writery thing? Do people get into writing and journalism who have that?
I'd say it's a young, ambitious, writerly thing. What's that? Was that Gore Vidal thing? I think it was Gore Vidal. It is not enough to succeed. Other people must fail.
Horrible.
But I felt that way in my 20s and 30s. I think a lot of it's to do with, like, ambition and capitalism. I was saying to somebody the other day, like, speaking of podcasts, like, the Brooklyn podcast community, understandably, it's like exceptionally competitive. Like, the producers are all, you know, very, very competitive with each other, and everyone's kind of a little bit on edge for those reasons. And I've just made this show with the BBC, with an in-house BBC producer, Sarah Sheffier, you know, who's so calm. It's almost like, and I was saying to somebody, it's like she's got tenure, like she's in-house at the BBC. She's like, it's almost like she's got tenure, like she doesn't need to be all uptight about things. And it's been such a pleasant experience working with Sarah, and you know, partly for that reason.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah, so it's not entirely to do with people's fucked up brains. I think it's partly to do with the situation that they're in as well, that certain situations force us to be competitive. With me and Louis, I don't know, I was like, I certainly felt some jealousy for a while, because a little bit like the Pixies must have felt when Nirvana got big, like he sort of leapfrogged, over me. But we're talking about the 90s and you know, many years have passed since then, and I don't feel that way at all anymore.
But he does, doesn't he? He said he still feels like a slight nastiness about it.
Yeah, that would have surprised and, you know, pleased me. Like, what's flattering? We always think everybody else's life is so much better. Like, he said the reason he still felt a certain sense of, you know, felt some nastiness towards me was because I'm doing well in America. But, you know, he doesn't really know what my life's like in America, whether I consider myself doing well or not well and so on. So, you know, it's very much his own thoughts which were leading him to think that way.
Well, America's a big deal for him because of his dad, I suppose. And also they get his name wrong, don't they? They say Thoreau.
Oh, right. Yeah, maybe. Yes.
Louis Thoreau.
Louis Thoreau.
Yeah, who's that guy?
Right. Yeah. To be honest, the thing that really stopped me feeling jealous about Louis was when we sort of veered on our different paths. Like, I started writing books and I thought, you know what, I'm never going to be as good a documentary presenter as Louis. Like, Louis is, I think Louis is like exceptional in the moment. Like Louis's in the most skill at being in the moment is like unsurpassed. And I suppose part of my jealousy in the 90s was thinking, you know, that's something that Louis does like better than me. And I don't think I could ever do it as well as Louis does it. And then as we sort of veered on different paths, that's when the jealousy, like, I thought, you know what, I write books really well. Louis does those documentaries really well. I don't need to be fucked up about this. I matured my way out of that destructive thought spiral. The best thing that came from it was a joke, which I would tell on stage sometimes, which is that...
Yeah, I think I know this.
That me and Louis were like conjoined twins, and that for one of us to grow stronger, the other one must die.
I didn't know that one. Sorry, that's not the joke I heard.
Okay. Oh, yeah, no, that was my joke, that we're like conjoined twins, and that for one of us to grow stronger, the other one has to die. And every time I said it on stage, like, it would get such a big laugh. And I'd think to myself, like, you know, I've said this too often now. But then I started thinking, but I can't deny the audience this amazing... So I just kept saying it because I just felt bad. Like, this audience doesn't get the big laugh, which I know they would do if they hear it. So I just kept saying it.
You've got to. Well, I think we do like, as an audience, we like a bit of gossip, don't we? And there's nothing better than when one famous person, even if it's not true or it's just a joke, they say something about another famous person. That's the best thing ever.
Yeah, so, that's really true. We like gossip.
You want to hear De Niro like going like, oh, the thing about Pacino.
Yeah. Tell you what I hate. Joe Pesci.
Rub me the wrong way. Always rub me the wrong way there, Joe Pesci. Oh, right. I should probably let you go, shouldn't I? Because you've got to prepare for another. You got all these back to back, don't you?
Only one other today. I'm only doing like only one other. And then I'm not doing anything for January. Yeah. Oh, I'm doing good. Lovely James in this show, Shame.
It's a great show. Which,
yeah, it's very good. I very much enjoyed his Kat Rosenfield. Do you know Kat Rosenfield?
No.
I'd check her out. She's really good. She used to be a YA author, and she got into a kerfuffle with other YA authors, and she sort of moved further into quote unquote the kind of heterodox world, the world of, you know, the kind of stuff that we've just been talking about.
Is she sort of the what side is she on?
Oh, she's how I'd describe her, you know, she's probably a kind of, I worry about giving people terms, but, you know, she's a moderate.
Oh, okay.
I just think she's very smart, expresses things in very clear. You should listen to her and you'll see how good she is.
Yeah, I can see. I'm looking at who follows her, and there's Colin Wright and Yasmin Mohammed, who was on the podcast, and lots. Oh, John McWhorter, who was on this podcast as well. Stephen Knight, who was on the podcast.
Oh, I know you had John McWhorter on. Yeah, and he's really fascinating.
He's amazing. Helen Pluck-Rose, who's on this podcast, William Costello, all the people who are on this podcast follow her. So she might be good to have on. That's a great suggestion.
Can I suggest somebody else as well?
Please.
Who I just think is really interesting. Katie Herzog. Have you come across Katie?
I think I may have even tried to get her on. I'm not sure because I send out so many emails over the months. And I'm pretty... Yes, because she does Blocked and Reported. I think at one point I emailed to suggest we go on each other's podcast and I don't think I got a reply.
Okay. well, they're both in that world, in that sort of sensuous, heterodox world. I like people from all the different worlds and thought processes. But from that sensuous world, I really like both of them a lot.
I'll send them messages. Thank you very much. I'll put this out in mid-Jan, and it's been brilliant. It's been such a pleasure speaking to you, really. It's a meet your heroes in a good way kind of thing.
Ah, Andrew, that's really kind. Thank you. And I heard your John McWhirter one and liked it very much. He's very interesting, right? Very interesting.
He was a thing that I had thinking when I was thinking about you as well. It's that when people get interviewed so much, you're thinking, what can I ask that's different? Because they've just answered the same question over and over. So I tried really hard with John McWhirter not to talk about the woke stuff at all and just to really go into linguistics and how language and offence changed. And I found the way he talks about it, he's a tour de force.
Mm, yeah, absolutely. He really is.
That's
well,
it.
That's
it's been
it.
Beautiful.
Thank you, Andrew. It was a pleasure.
Oh, it's been so nice. I hope to get you on next time you got something out or whatever. And, you know, we'll speak again. And, have a lovely day. And say hi to James from me.
Yeah, I will do. I'm going to be talking to him in 22 minutes.
Have a good day, John. Lovely to meet you. I said your name because I'm sure it is John. So I've got it. I know the anxiety.
It's John.
Yeah. See you.
Bye. Bye.
Thanks, John, for doing that. You're my hero, and I can't tell you, everyone, how surreal it was to be sitting there face to face across a computer screen talking to the very man in whose path I hoped to tread. He was everything I had hoped for. They say never meet your heroes, and a lot of these people are a bit prickly or difficult in real life. John came in already laughing and smiling, and it just set the tone and put me totally at ease. He was like, oh, hello, you know, like that. And I was just like, oh, okay, all right, okay, he's like I hoped. And it was so nice. Remember that you can find Things Fell Apart on the BBC Sounds app. And if you're outside of the UK, you'll be able to get it on all the normal podcast platforms from the 25th of January. Trust me, it's worth a listen. I really like the music from it too. It's stuck in my head all the time. It's just perfect. This sort of whimsical piano thing. It's really nice. If you're new to this podcast, please do subscribe and get in touch to say hi on AndrewGold_OK on Twitter or Instagram. Follow John, of course, on his John Ronson Twitter things and Instagram. He's got loads of followers and you should follow him as well. He's fantastic to follow. But yes, I love to hear from you listeners. Sign up on patreon.com/AndrewGold or Apple for the bonus episodes, as well as to get early access to the ads-free version of the full podcast. Comes out a few days early, the Wednesday before usually. There's a YouTube page too for the video versions of the podcast, so come subscribe to the On the Edge with Andrew Gold channel. Please review on Apple, Castbox, or the Spotify mobile app where you can now give a rating. I had a great Apple review the other week from JSKI94 in the US, who gave 5 stars and wrote, "Love this show. Andrew's an excellent interviewer and his guests are always interesting people from all walks of life. If you like Jordan Harbinger, you'll also appreciate Andrew Gold. Keep up the great work, Andrew." Thank you so much for saying so. I imagine you were sort of put onto this from the lovely Jordan Harbinger, on whose show I was recently a guest, and he's coming on here soon as well, so you'll be able to hear his episode on my podcast. Fascinating man. In the coming weeks should be, yes, Jordan Harbinger, the kidnapped podcaster, investigative journalist from the Underworld podcast, Sean Williams, to talk about all kinds of crime dealy things that he's been investigating. I think young adult writer Kat Rosenfield, who had a scuffle or an argument with the woke young adult literature crowd. Historian Peter Hughes, who wrote a book about statues, with people knocking them down these days, and you know what they mean and what it means to knock down statues, and many, many more people all lined up at the moment. But yeah, I'm not exactly sure the order yet, but I'll see you next week.